You open your Bibles, please, to Genesis chapter 38. Genesis chapter 38, we are in the middle of the story of Joseph being taken down to Egypt, and that was chapter 37. We'll pick that up in chapter 39 with Joseph arriving in Egypt and the details that take place there. What we have here in chapter 38 is a story that continues in the land of Canaan, dealing with one of Joseph's brothers, Judah. Probably what we have is, again, a proof that we've got several documents being put together here in the book of Genesis by the editor Moses. You've got the account of the Egyptian story coming again in 39 to the end of the end of the book. But here maybe is a different document from a different source that Moses put together, recording what took place in the land of Judah in the land of Canaan with Judah, one of Joseph's brothers. So if we would open again to chapter 38, verse 1, I'll read the first verse, and then we'll start. Got a lot of things happening in this chapter, basically just a family story. Should say this also. Joseph is going to be taken down to Egypt at the age of 17. At the age of 30, he's going to be exalted to the throne of leadership there in Egypt. So that's a 13-year period. But his brothers, there's going to be a seven years of plenty, and then there's going to be 7 years of famine. So it's during this time, if we can say 13 years of Joseph being a slave and in prison, then there's going to be 7 years of plenty, of abundant harvest, followed by seven more years. But his brothers are going to arrive around the second year of that famine. So that's a total of 22 years. So in other words, this chapter 38 could easily cover a period of 22 years if you have a little bit before and a little bit after. This is what was taking place from the time they sold Joseph as a 17-year-old until they arrive and begin dealing with Joseph, who's now in charge of the land of Egypt. So 22 years. In other words, the reason I'm telling you that is if you look at what's in here, Judah is going to get married. He's going to have three sons. Those sons are going to grow up. Two of them are going to marry or be involved with the same woman. They are going to die, and then Judah is going to have two more sons. And so it's like, that's a lot of activity in a short period of time. But 22 years is enough time if we allow it to make sense that way. So here we go. Chapter 38, verse 1. It says, at that time, Judah left his brothers and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hira. Now, at that time, at what time? Well, continuing right here, as Joseph is going down into Egypt, meanwhile, Judah is also leaving his brothers. Joseph is being forced to leave his brothers by being sold into slavery. Judah, remember, here's a map very quickly. Here we go. Dead Sea. Up in here was Dothan, where they were watching their animals or their sheep. Hebron is right here. From Dothan, Joseph was sold into slavery. And he, of course, is leaving his brothers. At that time, Judah himself is going to leave his family. He's going to move west. I'm going to give you a little bit. There's going to be basically four cities here we're going to talk about today. Just interesting to know where they are. Tony, we were right beside one of the main ones. They were in the area of Hebron right here, and what we've got is four cities. The first one is the city called Adullam, A-D-U-L-L-A-M. It's going to be northwest of Hebron, southwest of Jerusalem or Bethlehem. And if you remember going through 1 Samuel, David hid in the cave of Adullam, and a couple psalms, or at least one psalm, was written from this later on. And, of course, this is right over there in the land of Judah. Now, also coming up later in our story is going to be the city of Timnah. And this is the city where Samson's going to be born. There's, again, a plain right here. You can see here's the Mediterranean coast right here. The land of the Philistines is right in this area. Timnah was very involved with the days of Samson. When the ark was sent back, it came to a city called Beth Shemesh, right in this area right there. So these are all familiar places to the Bible. Two cities that are also going to pop up in our story is a place called Kezib, right? It's going to be right over here, Kezib. I'm just showing you this so we can read the story and bite past these. And there's going to be another little city at one time in this story, Judah, who's living around the area of Adullam, away from his family, had his own business, his own sheep. He's going to go up to Timnah, where some of his sheep are at for shearing season. And he's going to pass by a small town right here called E-N-A-I-M, a name. right here. So these are your four cities in the day story. He's leaving Hebron to go to Adullam. He's going to have one of his sons is going to be born in Kazib. He's going to go up and shear his sheep in the city of Timnah and pass by the city of Anim. And again, this is the area all this is taking place. Okay. At that time, Judah left his brothers from Hebron, where their base is at, and went down to stay with a man of Adullam named Hiram, over to Adullam. Again, these are now Canaanite people. Now, this is interesting because as you go through this, we've had Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Abraham, remember, sent his servant to get a wife for Isaac. He didn't want a Canaanite woman. He understood the importance of keeping his family separate from the ways of the world. They went to a great length to bring down Rebekah from the land of Padan Aram to marry Isaac. Isaac, the same way, sent Jacob up north to Padan Aram to find a wife. He found four of them. Well, two of them, Rachel and Leah, come from the same their family, and they return. This is now the fourth generation. This is now Judah. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Judah, one of the 12 brothers, and doesn't quite have that commitment. Here we go right here. Verse 2, there Judah in Adullam, where he went to live with the Canaanites, there Judah met the daughter of a Canaanite man named Shua. That's all we know about her. She is the daughter of Shua, a Canaanite woman. No name. She's going to produce three sons for Judah, but we don't even know her name. We just know that she is a Canaanite. And she's now married and living with Judah here in Adullam. Very quickly, this whole thing has deteriorated. Understand, just as we foresee what's coming at the end of Genesis, Israel's going to leave this whole land and go down into Egypt. During this time of Egypt, they're going to end up becoming slaves and be in oppression. But they're going to develop a nation. They're going to develop a culture, an identity as a people down here in slavery. If you can imagine what would have taken place, especially looking at Jacob's sons, looking at what Judah's doing right here as what they did to Shechem, what they did to Joseph, and now Judah, who just simply marries a Canaanite woman and is fine with it, what would have become of the family of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob if they were allowed to stay here and live in freedom in the land of the Canaanites? My guess, and many people just look at this, by the fourth generation, they're just marrying it. It's like no big deal. They've already lost sight of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob and the covenant that God has with them. And possibly the only way to save them, just kind of a, just not necessarily a doctrinal point, but by being forced to go to Egypt to become a people living in the land of Goshen there in the Nile Delta, and then being forced into slavery, they began to form an identity, a community that was going to become the nation that God intended. If they were allowed to be here, they themselves didn't even want to become a nation. They didn't even want to be separate from the world. They simply wanted to just make a living and enjoy life. And you can see that taking place already. So possibly the slavery of Egypt maybe saved the nation of Israel from just becoming another Canaanite race. Well, he married the woman. He married her and lay with her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Er. E-R. Here we go. E-R. You got that map memorized? Okay. So we've got a Canaanite wife, and she's going to have three sons. E-R, Onan, and Shula. How do you spell this? Shula. Sheila. S-H-E-L-A-H. These are the three sons she's going to have. Let's read through this. He married her and lay with her. She became pregnant and gave birth to a son who was named Er, E-R. She conceived again and gave birth to a son named Onan, O-N-A-N. She gave birth to still another son, named him Shelah. It was at Kazib that she gave birth to him. So that was just like that city that was just southwest of Adullam. Judah got a wife for Er. So things are moving along fairly quickly in the storyline here. Er is going to grow up. He's going to be at least a teenager now. I don't know exactly what age he's going to be, but notice this. He gets a wife for Er, for his firstborn. Her name was Tamar. We also find out in other references here in the Bible, Chronicles and different places, that Tamar herself is a Canaanite. So not being particular, Abraham was very particular when he found a wife for Isaac. Isaac was very particular when Jacob found a wife. Judah wasn't particular necessarily. He just found someone, doesn't even mention her name. And when it came time to find a wife for his son, just any Canaanite woman is going to do, not really concerned about the Abraham covenant of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And again, point out the fact, it doesn't seem to be on the surface here. The very fact that God has called them isn't even important. Tamar is Er's wife. But it says in verse 7, Er, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the Lord's sight. So the Lord put him to death. This is the first time in the Bible the Lord is credited with putting someone to death individually. He's wiped out the whole earth with the flood. He's wiped out Sodom and Gomorrah with what took place there. But in this case right here, an individual, one in the line of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Judah, this heir is, E-R, is the eldest son of Judah, who is going to, by the end of the book, is going to, end of Genesis, is going to be the royal line of Abraham. It's going to be the line of the Messiah. E-R, heir, is going to be one of the most important people in the lineage. For some unknown reason, it just says, was wicked in the Lord's sight. We don't know what that was. We don't know if it was an attitude, if it was an action, if it was repeated. We don't know the details. We just know that the Lord put him to death and stopped this. It's like Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah, and now heir. It's like, no way. Once again, the four-generation cycle, the fifth generation, it's like, why is there no fifth generation? The Lord puts an end to it. Just another example of it in the Scripture. This is bad. We're going to stop this. The decline has gone too far, and E.R. is eliminated from history. And again, the Lord puts him to death. Now, Judah is very concerned because he is in a position of having an inheritance. His oldest son, which was very important because he was the heir of the estate, is gone. So he wants a son to replace this, a son to give his inheritance to. He could give it to Onan, but then Onan would get, in a sense, two shares. He wants to give E.R., or heir share, to a son. So now notice what takes place. This is, again, showing you the decline of an attitude. It's showing you how people at this stage don't recognize other people or see other people as valuable. They will use people. Look at this right here. Verse 8, then Judah said to Onan, his second son, lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to produce offspring for your brother. Sounds very biblical. Have a son for your brother who died. And again, we're going to look at that here in just a moment. But I want you to notice a couple things. He doesn't tell Onan to marry her. He doesn't even say, and she'll be your wife. He says, lie with your brother's wife. She's still not going to be Onan's wife. He says, I just need a descendant. I need a son. So sleep with her and give me a child. There's no commitment. There's no covenant. There's nothing, in a sense, biblical about this arrangement. He's just going to use the situation. Lie with your brother's wife and fulfill your duty to her as a brother-in-law to produce offspring for your brother. But Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. He knew that if he did this, if he fulfilled this responsibility and he produced a son, this son would then get the estate. So in other words, Onan, in a sense, is shooting himself in the foot, hurting himself, hurting his own estate by doing this thing. Because, again, if he has the son is going to, in a sense, receive the firstborn share, which is the major portion. If Onan doesn't fulfill his duty, this son is not produced, and Onan is now forced to be the oldest son with the favorite share of the inheritance. In other words, by producing offspring for heir, Onan maintains his status as the second son. If he refuses to do this, he then is going to be forced to be the firstborn son. Judah is thinking about himself and says, sleep with Tamar. You don't need to marry her, just sleep with her. Onan is thinking about himself. He'll sleep with her, but he's not going to have a son. Well, here we get see this in the next verse. But Onan knew that, verse 9, but Onan knew that the offspring would not be his. So whenever he lay with his brother's wife, important word, whenever, it doesn't say, so that one time that he did sleep with her, it's like whenever he continued to sleep with her, he's not arguing with that. It's like, sure, bring Tamar in. Whenever he would sleep with her, whenever he lay with his brother's wife, he spilled his semen on the ground to keep from producing offspring for his brother. In other words, this is not a matter of birth control. It's not like, well, birth control's not right, or that's not the point. The point is he had an obligation to fulfill for his family, for Tamar, for his father, for the inheritance, and he refused to do it. He refused to, in a sense, finish the job. And it says right here, what he did was wicked in the Lord's sight. So the Lord put him to death also. So now Onan is dead, and we know why he died. He died because he spilled his seed, in a sense, so that he may not fulfill his duty. He spilled his seed so that this son would not occur, keep him out of history. That is what it is. Just a point right here. This is not, he's not killed because he used birth control. Okay, you understand? You can see how this is why. Why is these things important? Well, because you get some strange doctrines that people pick and choose. The issue here is not he used birth control. The issue here is he didn't fulfill his responsibility. He didn't do what was right. The use of the word wicked here, again, may give us some indication of what's taking place with ER or heir up here. But nonetheless, heir is dead. Onan is dead. But Tamar is still here. So who does Judah think is responsible? Tamar is the problem. Again, once again, you become biblically illiterate. You don't understand the way God is working. You end up blaming the wrong people and come to the wrong conclusion. So Tamar is the problem. Let's look at a couple things very quickly here about what was trying to be done right here with Judah and his son. I want you to first go to Deuteronomy chapter 25. Deuteronomy 25. And even in the law of Moses, which is going to be coming later, it's going to be an established principle. This ideal of a son or a brother marrying his brother's wife to produce an heir so that he might preserve his estate was taking place in Genesis. It's in the law of Moses. It continued up through the time of Judges, obviously. We got the book of Ruth. And it's going to go all the way up until the time of Jesus in the New Testament. This was the practice. Remember the story of the Sadducees came and asked Jesus, we had a man who had a wife and he died and she ends up marrying seven different brothers and then finally she died. And Jesus asked that question. This is the last week of his ministry. So what we're looking at here is a principle, and it was part of establishing or continuing the estate. I'm in Deuteronomy chapter 25, verse 7. I'm going to read this to you, but I just find this interesting, a little bit of detail. Chapter 25, verse 7. However, if a man does not want to marry his brother's wife, she shall go to the eldest at the town gate and say, my husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me. In other words, for her preservation, so she's not just out on the streets alone, she was to have this son. Continue the estate, give her an inheritance, keep the line going. But notice right here, if a man does not want to do it, if Onan, one of his problems was he said, okay, sure, send her in. But he didn't do his job. He said, yeah, I'll pretend, I'll play along whenever it needs to be done, I'll do it. But he didn't do it. At least the man here in Deuteronomy, when the father Judah comes and says, Onan, do this job, he says, no, I will not. I do not want to become legally bound like this. But it was still his responsibility. Onan is corrupt on a couple levels. One, he says he'll do it, but he doesn't. And the other one is just it's simply his responsibility. Number next, it goes on, I'm in chapter 25, verse 7. And the wife is to say, so Tamar is supposed to come and say, my husband's brother refuses to carry on his brother's name in Israel. He will not fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to me. Verse 8, then the elders of his town shall summon him and talk to him. If he persists in saying, I do not want to marry her, this brother's widow shall go up to him in the presence of the elders, take off one of his sandals and spit in his face and say, this is what is done to the man who will not marry to build up his brother's family line. That man's line shall be known in Israel as the family of the unsandaled. So in other words, it was a great disgrace. And the widow could bring him in and say, talk to the man. And the elder would sit down and say, do you understand what you're doing? You're interrupting the flow of the inheritance. You're interrupting the flow of a family. You're not providing this woman with an heir. You are selfish and just concerned about yourself. And he says, I know, but that's the way I'm going to live. I'm just going to do what I want to do. In that case, the widow comes in, removes the man's sandal, which would be a disgrace in front of all the other elders in the city gate, and spits in his face. A widow, a woman, spitting in a man's face for not taking her in, not taking care of her. And that family then from then on is known as the unsandaled. Just while we're here, flip over to, not we're there, but we're heading there. Go to Ruth. We're going to be back to the book of Ruth later. Joshua, Judges, and then the book of Ruth, right before 1 Samuel. Without giving you the whole story of Ruth, some of you are familiar with this. This is just a few years later. This is, it'd be several hundred years later, but it's within the same time frame. Ruth is in a position where she herself, we're in Ruth chapter 4, looking in verse 7. Ruth is, her husband has died, and she's looking to marry into the family. And there's a man who doesn't want to marry her. Boaz says, hey, I will marry her. But he says, there's someone else in front of me that is responsible to carry this on. He said, we've got to talk to him. Just, I'm going to read this right here, chapter 4, verse 6. At this time, Ruth chapter 4, verse 6, and they've got this little court case going at the city gate. And Boaz is saying, Ruth needs to have an opportunity to marry this kinsman redeemer and continue the family line. Verse 6, at this time the kinsman redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. And in fact, they just said, well, listen, there's an estate right here that if she has a son, it's going to go this way. He said, man, if I follow through this, I'll endanger my own estate. This is not financially wise for me to marry her. You redeem her yourself. I cannot do it. Verse 7. Now, in earlier times in Israel, this is a little footnote put in here by the editor of this, saying this is what was taking place. Now, in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. This was the method of legalizing transactions in Israel, the removal of the sandal. Verse 8, so the kinsman redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself, and removed his sandal. Took off his sandal and says, it's no longer my responsibility. I'm transferring this right to you by removing his sandal. Notice before in the book of Deuteronomy, the woman would actually walk up and grab the man's sandal herself and jerk it off and spit on him, not even giving him the chance to finalize. Says, I will reject you first. But nonetheless, just understand that what's taking place here in Genesis is going to continue throughout Israeli history in the Middle East there. So we go back to Genesis chapter 38. In verse 9, whenever Onan would sleep with Tamar, he'd spill the seed, no child, so God strikes down Onan for not fulfilling his responsibility. Now we've got Tamar, who is still a widow. There's one more son left to fulfill the responsibility. And Judah now, always thinking of himself, and having been trained in deception. Verse 11, Judah then said to his daughter-in-law, Tamar, live as a widow in your father's house until my son Shelah grows up. Until he's of marrying age. You just go back to your Canaanite father, live there as a widow, and then when my son Shelah is old enough, we'll try this again. For he thought, he may die too, just like his brothers. So Tamar went to live with her father's house. In his mind, he's thinking, there's no way I'm going to give my last son, my last hope of an inheritance, his last hope of a lineage right here. Now watch how this is all going to play out. Shelah is his last hope of having a line. The line of Judah, the line of the Messiah, the line of King David, is now down to one individual right here who Judah is going to say, no, I can't risk him marrying Tamar. So you just go live, I'll come get you later. Okay, that's where that's left off at. Now, verse 12. Again, we're covering a lot of time in this whole story. We're covering, 22 years. After a long time, Judah's wife, the daughter of Shua, remember that's his wife, the Canaanite wife, that's all we know about her, daughter of Shua, she died. When Judah had recovered from his grief, he went up to Timnah. Now remember on Timnah the map I drew, that's just a little bit northeast, now heading towards a little more towards Jerusalem, about 4 miles northeast of Jerusalem. Judah had recovered from his grief. He went up to Timnah to the men who were shearing his sheep. Now, when they're shearing the sheep, that would be a time, that's a harvest festival. They've been raising the sheep, their wool's thick, and they're going to have the harvest. We see this in David's time, in David's son's time. Whenever they'd have the sheep shearing, it was a great party, a great feast, a lot of activity, a lot of parties, a lot of celebration, a lot of feasting. So this is a time of celebration. He's recovered from his grief, from his wife having died, and now they're going to go shear sheep. And his friend Hira, the Adullamite, went with him. This is a guy that he originally moved in to do business with down there in Adullam. And now they're going to go from Adullam, 4 miles northeast, towards the city of Timnah. There's a town in between. They're a little village. And as he goes by, that's where Tamar lives with her father. Verse 13. When Tamar was told, your father-in-law is on his way to Timnah to shear his sheep, and thus he'll be passing through your city, she took off her widow's clothes, covered herself with a veil to disguise herself, and then sat down at the entrance to Enaim, E-N-A-I-M, a small town. Again, maybe she's from there, or she just knew that was on the way there, but she goes there, covers herself with a veil, which is on the road to Timnah. She knows exactly where he's passing by. She knows exactly that this is a time of feasting. She knows that his wife has died. And she knows that Shelah is old enough, his last son, is old enough to have been given to her to fulfill her his responsibility for it. But he's pretty much abandoned her. Judah has abandoned his responsibilities as the father-in-law. For she saw that Shelah had now grown up. She had not been given him as a wife. When Judah saw her, he thought she was a prostitute. She's got herself veiled, just standing on the street corner, just standing there. Like, and you think, whoa, hey. And the veil, there's a lot of discussion about the veil, if the veil's a veil, or if the veil's some kind of makeup or paint to cover the face. And all these things were taking place in the ancient world, especially in the era of prostitution. For she had covered her face. In other words, the idea here is her face is covered either with a veil or makeup or paint or something. She's not recognizable by Judah, especially since he hasn't seen her for a couple of years. Not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law. Now notice daughter-in-law through heir and, in a sense, Onan, but actually betrothed to Shelah. What he had said to her was, I will wait until he's of marrying age, and that's a betrothal. That's an engagement. That is exactly, in a sense, what Joseph and Mary had when it says, and they were, he was engaged or betrothed to Mary, Joseph, in the Gospels account. Is that they weren't married yet, but they were, the legal documents were in place, just waiting for the day to arrive where they would fulfill this commitment. And Shelah now is, in a sense, betrothed to Tamar through Judah's agreement. So he doesn't realize that's his daughter-in-law who's now engaged to Shelah, who he won't give to her, has no idea. It goes on and says, verse 16, not realizing that she was his daughter-in-law, he went over to her by the roadside and says, come now, let me sleep with you. And what will you give me to sleep with you, she asked. I'll send you a young goat from my flock, which must have been a good price there for a good deal. But he does. I don't have one with me. I left my credit card at home. I'll send a young goat from my flock, he says. She says, outthinking him, would you give me something as a pledge until you send it? I need something, just some kind of a commitment, something that you'll need to make sure you get back. He says, well, sure. What pledge should I give you? What are you thinking? Your steel and its cord and the staff in your hand. Now, this is basically access to his checking account. The seal is not just a decoration or a cute ring or a little necklace. It could be a ring or it could be some kind of a necklace, but since it's got a cord, it's probably a necklace. It could be metal or stone. And what it has on there is an engravement, which is his name, which is how he would seal documents. He'd press it into clay or press it into wax or something. It was his signature. It was his name. She says, well, just give me your name. So he says, okay, and he takes off his necklace with the seal on it, gives it to her. And then, of course, the staff, there's some discussion about what the staff would be. It may be something similar, like a pin of some sort, some kind of a, that would hold something together. But it could actually be a staff with some kind of name or carving, identification on it. Either way, both of these things, the seal and its cord and the staff, are things that are easily recognizable. When you have them, it's like, well, these are Judah's. This is Judah's been here. This is Judah's stuff. It's like giving someone your credit card or your PIN number to your bank account or signing your name to a check. It's like, well, here, hold this. Keep this and I'll be back for it. It's what happens when you go to the gas station and you fill up with gas but you don't have any money or a credit card. All you have is your license. And they say, well, you can drive off but leave your license here and you'll give it back to you when you come with the money. And you got, have you ever done that? Okay. That's what they'll do if you drive off. I don't have any money. Well, leave something here that's valuable. How about my driver's license? Good enough. They put it there in the cash drawer until you come back with the money, and then they give you your driver's license back. That's what she's doing. Ah, she says, he says, what do you want for a pledge? She says, your driver's license? Oh, okay. And he leaves his driver's license, in a sense, with her. Your seal in verse 18, halfway through, your seal and its cord and the staff in your hand, she answered. So he gave them to her and slept with her, and she became pregnant by him. Uh-oh. Now Tamar is now pregnant through, here's his name, Judah. So we've got a huge mess. Er has died. Onan has died. But Tamar has been rejected to receive Shelah, the youngest son. So Judah unknowingly sleeps with Tamar, and she's going to produce a child. And Judah doesn't know this. Okay, After verse 19, after she left, she took off her veil, put on her widow's clothes again, and went about her day. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat by his friend, the Adullamite, the one we met in the first verse. He says, hey, go back down there on our way back. Maybe he's up here at the feast, you know, up in Timnah, just a few miles away, a couple miles away. He sends the Adullamite back with the goat. Says, go pay that person. And he changes the name right here. You can see it, her called something different. Because he doesn't call her a prostitute. He calls her a shrine or cultic prostitute. And the difference there is the shrine prostitutes were of noble character. They worked in some kind of a religious organization. They worked in the shrine or the temple. And it was part of their culture, even during harvesting time, during the threshing or during the sheep harvesting, is they would worship the gods through these temple prostitutes to get a bigger crop, get a larger harvest. And so, in other words, right here, although he knew that's not what her case was, since she's just standing out there in the street corner, they switch her name from just being a street prostitute to a shrine prostitute. It's a noble class of people. It's a good, you know, recognized career. Verse 20. Meanwhile, Judah sent the young goat with his friend Adullamite in order to get his pledge back from the woman, but he did not find her. He asked the men who lived there, where is the shrine prostitute who was beside the road at a name? There hasn't been a shrine prostitute here. We don't have a temple. Why would we have a shrine? We don't even have a shrine. What are you talking about? So he went back to Judah and says, I didn't find her. Besides, the men who lived there said, there hasn't been any shrine prostitute here. They have no idea what you're talking about. So now, Judah, things have gotten worse. And what you're going to see here is a situation similar to David, is there's going to be a sin, then there's going to be a time of quiet where they're going to think, well, this will just kind of go away. David thought the same thing with Bathsheba. And then all of a sudden, things are going to become exposed, but they're not sure. They're not really seeing themselves in the trap yet. They're going to be trapped, but they're going to have some kind of righteous, I can't spell indignation, so I'll just write that as if you can even see it, righteous indignation. And then they're going to realize that they are in a trap and they have been revealed. So it's going to go from a sin to trying to keep it quiet, because it's going to be more embarrassing to address the sin than just keep it quiet. Then they're going to be righteous indignation, where they're going to reveal their own judgment of the case, which then they find out it's on themselves. And here we go. Watch what Judah says. After the Adullamite comes back, his friend, his business partner, says, well, she's not there. Verse 23, then Judah says, let her keep what she has, or we'll become a laughingstock. After all, I did send her this young goat, but you did not find her. He says, well, first of all, I did send the goat. I tried to make the payment, but we didn't find her. So we're innocent there. I don't know where she went. But he says, we're not going to go look for my seal and my staff, because we'll become a laughingstock. Running around, how are you going to find your seal and your staff? I gave my driver's license to a prostitute. Has anybody seen it? It's like, Judah, it's like, how is he going to begin to search for this? It's like, we just hope that she doesn't use the credit card. We're just going to pretend it's never happened. He's lost his name. He's lost his identity. But in order to find it, he's going to have to become an embarrassment to himself. So it's like, okay, it's going to be better if we just leave this thing go. Forget it and it will go away. And that's exactly what David thought with Bathsheba. He waited a year until Nathan the prophet came and talked to him and told him a story. And tells him the story, hey, there was this man who did this thing. And he says, David, what do you think should happen to that man? And David says, that man should die. That's wrong. And same thing is going to happen here with Judah. Tamar is going to bring the evidence. Well, here we go. Let's read this. About verse 24, about 3 months later, Judah was told, your daughter-in-law, Tamar, is guilty of prostitution. And as a result, she is now pregnant. Can you believe that woman? And Judah, of course, in his self-righteous state, says, what? I can't believe my daughter-in-law, who's betrothed to my son, Shelah, who we've trusted all these years, has gone out and done this thing. Well, typical to the ancient culture in the area of the Canaanites, in Egypt, around, is sins that involve this kind of behavior. Law of Moses has a couple places for it also. They aren't just killed, but they are burnt. Yeah. Judah says, bring her out and have her burned to death. That is for this kind of a sin, that was the going payment. Bring her out here, and now again, notice the fairness of the trial. Someone comes and says, I have heard that Tamar is pregnant and she's been a prostitute. Well, let's burn her. There's no court case. There's no hearing. Let's hear what she's got to say. Let's find out about this. So they send to bring her. They send to bring her for the burning. And Judah's going to oversee the burning of this wicked woman. And he's happy probably because, well, that gets him off the hook with Sheila. The woman's not worthy of my son Sheila. So he's going to play this up good. Verse 25, as she was being brought out, drug out of her house, she sent a message to her father-in-law, Judah. I am pregnant by the man who owns these, she said. And she added, see if you recognize whose seal and cord and staff these are. She says, oh, I can tell you who the father of the child is, and sends these on ahead. And the guys that come, they says, hey, we've got evidence who caused this. Judah said, well, let's find the man too. They says, here they are. Here's his, we've got his name. We've got his credit card. Here it is. Who is this? Judah never really answers that question. And she added, see if you recognize, verse 26, Judah recognized them and said, she is more righteous than I. He doesn't say, oh, they're mine, burn me too. He says, she is more righteous than I. Let's just stop with that. That's enough information. Since I wouldn't give her to my son, Sheila. Oh, she says, no, he says, I understand the situation. I wouldn't give her to my son, Sheila, so she's gone off and found another man. I understand. I'll take these. And it never really comes out that he says, oh, these are mine. Woe is me. He just says, oh, she's more righteous than me. I didn't give her to my son, Sheila. I'll take these. Still trying to recover himself. And he did not sleep with her again. Verse 27. When the time came for her to give birth, there were twin boys in her womb. And now the story is going to continue here with the genealogy. And you're going to know why this story is in the Bible. Because now you've got, Judah's got three sons, Er, Onan, and Sheila. Er and Onan are gone. Sheila is alive yet. And he's going to end up having a family that's going to settle right in that area from through another wife. It's recorded in other places. He's going to have his own family line. But Tamar now is going to produce two children. And we've got the first one is going to be called Perez. P-E-R-E-Z. And the next one is Zerah. Z-E-R-A-H. This is important. Perez is important. And here's the birth again. When the time came to give birth, there was twin boys in her womb. As she was giving birth, one of them put out his hand. So the midwife took a scarlet thread and tied it on his wrist and said, this is the one who came out first. But when he drew back his hand, his brother came out, and she said, this is how you have broken out. And that's what Perez means, broken out. Again, the younger bursting out in front, being born first. And he was named Perez. Then his brother, who had the scarlet thread on his wrist, came out, and he was given the name Zerah. So now we've got Perez and Zerah. So Judah now still has three sons, Sheila, Perez, and Zerah. Now, I'm going to ask you, please, if you would, go to the book of Ruth, Ruth chapter 4. And one more time, we look at a few verses here. Ruth chapter 4, verse 18. And we know the genealogy. What we're doing is building the genealogy of the Abrahamic line, especially the line of Judah. Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and now Judah. Judah's line was going to be stopped right here with Sheila. But through this situation with Tamar, Perez and Zerah are born. And so now we come to chapter 4, verse 16, the end of the book of Ruth. And this again is why the book of Ruth is important, because it continues this genealogy. Then Naomi took the child that had been born to Ruth, laid him in her lap, and cared for him. The woman living there says, Naomi has a son. And they named him Obed, O-B-E-D. He was the father of Jesse, who was the father of David. Now we have, this is the family line of Perez. And so beginning in verse 18, you already know Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Judah. Now you know Judah's son. Now you know the rest of the story. Is Perez. It's not Sheila. It's not Zerah. Perez is now the one they're going to trace the genealogy through because he was the firstborn through Tamar and Judah. Not a great story, is it? Perez, and there you see, Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron, the father of Ram. Ram the father of Abinadab, Abinadab the father of Nashon, Nashon the father of Salmon. Now, Salmon, my friends, you're going to catch up with him because he is going to be one of the two spies used by Joshua to go over and spy on Jericho. So between Perez is going to go down into Egypt with his father Judah and his family between, there you go, Hezron, Ram, Abinadab, and Nashon are all going to be in Egypt, and Nashon is going to be that generation that dies in the wilderness, but Salmon is going to be one of them with Joshua, who goes over and sneaks into Jericho, hides in Rahab's house, and in the later genealogies, it's going to give Rahab's name, and guess who Rahab is going to marry? Salmon. So Rahab is going to be in this genealogy through Salmon. Salmon was the father of Boaz, and now you know who Ruth married, Boaz. Boaz was a legendary figure in the area of Bethlehem, one of the first settlers whose own father was one of the spies who worked for Joshua. So Boaz is a fabulous family name. He has the son right here born to Ruth that just finishes this book named Obed. Obed has a son named Jesse, who in 1 Samuel is an old man who has his own line of sons, which the youngest one is named David. So that's what we've got happening right there. I need you to go, please, to the book of Matthew, Matthew chapter 1. And if you know these things, this is one of the reasons why this is an amazing, amazing account. Matthew chapter 1, it's going to seem like Christmas here for a brief moment. Matthew chapter 1, but in this line of Jesus' genealogy, when Matthew records it, he doesn't just give you the names of the men. He gives you the names of the men and a few of the wives, and when you get some of the names of the wives, you get some of the stories that are going on behind the scenes. I mean, there's so many things that you can see in this. Right here, you've got the Abrahamic covenant. God says, I am going to do this. And if Judah wants to mess it up, go ahead and mess it up. But I'll still pick up wherever he messes up, and I'm going to keep going. This is going to happen. The Messiah is going to come through Judah, is going to come through Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And none of this stuff, I'll just knock off the people that are going to interfere with it and just keep right on going. I don't want to scare you here with Er and Onan, but it's like God says, they're not going to cooperate. I'll remove them and find another situation. Not justifying the sin, but again, using what is available. Here we go. Chapter 1 of Matthew, a record of the genealogy of Jesus Christ, the son of David, the son of Abraham. You know these things, but just notice, look at it written down. Abraham was the father of Isaac, and you know that story. Isaac, the father of Jacob, the two sons, Esau and Jacob. Jacob goes up, gets a wife. Jacob was the father of Judah and his brothers, all 12 of them. Judah was the father of Perez and Zerah, whose mother was Tamar. Do we need to put that in there? Why can't we just say Judah was the father of Perez? Why do we got to mention the twins? And why do we got to mention Tamar, who was actually Judah's daughter-in-law? It's like, this is not looking good. This is the genealogy of Jesus Christ. I mean, we're in the fourth generation, and we've got twins born to Judah's daughter-in-law through Judah. Perez was the father of Hezron. Hezron the father of Ram. These are the guys that went into Egypt. Ram was the father of Abinadab. These guys were slaves in Egypt. Abinadab was the father of Nashon. Nashon was one of them that died in the wilderness. And Nashon was the father of Salmon, one of the spies. Salmon was the father of Boaz, whose mother was Rahab. You see, that was the father of Boaz. Well, who was Salmon's mother or wife? Well, it's Rahab. And Rahab also is known as an innkeeper, or in the book of James calls her a prostitute also. Boaz was the father of Obed, whose mother's name was Ruth. So already in the lineage of Jesus Christ, you've got Tamar, who was a Canaanite. You've got Rahab, who was a Canaanite from Jericho. And you've got Ruth, who, if you read the book of Ruth, was a Moabite. Well, we're not done yet. Obed is the son of Ruth and Boaz. Obed was the father of Jesse, who right now is, if you want to know the truth right here, is 5/8, Jesse is 5/8 Jewish, 1/8 Canaanite, 1/4 Moabite. Yeah. And Jesse, the father of King David, if you do the math continues, he is 13/16 Jewish. David was the father of Solomon, whose mother was Uriah's wife, and Uriah's wife was Bathsheba, and she was a Hittite, also a Canaanite. Solomon's father, and it continues on the genealogy. So between Abraham and Solomon, you've got four foreign women, Canaanite or Moabite or Jerichoite, born in this thing. And again, that's where do we get that information? It's recorded there in the Old Testament in Genesis. Let's go back to chapter 37 or 38 of Genesis. And what we've seen here in this, just this account of this story, we're going to pick up in chapter 39, verse 1. Look at 39, verse 1. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt. Potiphar, an Egyptian who was one of Pharaoh's officials, the captain of the guard, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him there. We're going to pick up with that story. But you can see how in the middle, where are you going to put chapter 38? If you're Moses, and if I'm correct, these are different documents that he's putting together, you've got this story of Judah, the lineage that connects Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Judah to the story of Ruth and Boaz. It's got to go in there somewhere. Of course, Moses doesn't know it's sure Ruth and Boaz, but it's important to be in there somewhere. Where are you going to put it? Are you going to put it at the end of Genesis? Well, no. Are you going to put it before the story of Joseph? Chronologically, this is where it goes. It fits right here. And it takes place those 22 years. So while these things are taking place, now in chapter 39, we go back to Egypt and follow up now the same 22 years, what's taking place in Joseph's life. But what we've seen in this chapter is one, the separation. Judah went ahead and crossed that line, married a Canaanite along with his sons who married a Canaanite, and the whole thing is deteriorating so that this fifth generation is already being eliminated because they've violated the covenant of God. They've walked away from the Abrahamic covenant. They don't even consider it serious. So God has to recover and not allow them to go into the fourth cycle of discipline already, as a family. So God saves them possibly by taking them into slavery. Once again, the oppression of Egypt may have saved. In fact, we know it forged Israel into who they were. When they came out of slavery, they were a mighty people. They had to stop thinking like slaves and start thinking like God wanted them to, but they themselves have been forged into a community. The next thing we see is the wicked being punished. Is when they come against God's plan, this does not mean that everybody that dies is being punished by God, but it does indicate that these two individuals were removed by God because of their wickedness. They're standing in the way of something very important, the Abrahamic covenant. You do not want to stand in the way of God's plan. God is well able. The flood, Tower of Babel or the Sodom and Gomorrah, or these two individuals who stand in the way of God's plan. A warning to us today, or people in general today, is like, God is still in control. And if you want to break His covenants, you break His laws, break His moral codes, there is judgment to pay. These two found out about it. The other thing we see is that sin is found out. We had the list right down here. Judah sinned, David sinned, they tried to hide it. But both of them got in a place where they both made the proclamation, the judgment, and then that judgment was turned on them. They ended up being trapped. And again, we see the hypocrisy that is so easily to fall into, which again, we can see in our own culture, saying, well, this is wrong or that's wrong or we got to stop this. But there are so many things because of morality, or I think of just like, you know, like the whole gay marriage thing. I'm going to end with this right here. The whole gay marriage thing, it's like, we've got to stop this. Yeah, we probably should do something about it. But realize the hypocrisy of the church. Are you ready for this one? This may be too much for you to handle. We'll just leave after this. The hypocrisy, it's like, it's going to ruin our culture. Indeed, homosexual marriage is a violation of God's will, God's plan. It is not natural. A junior high student would say it's gay in a negative sense. But anyway, that's supposed to be funny. But it is in junior high. But understand, the church has accepted the breakdown of marriage for the last 40 or 50 or 60 years. They're just letting marriages crumble. Divorce, single-parent families, children being raised without families or having, you know, all these crazy situations. Let me tell you what. Read Hope for America's Last Generation. I mentioned homosexuality one time in that, just in a bullet point as one of the sins of the Canaanites. But we spend a lot of time on the failure of the family, the failure of marriage. Our culture is crumbling, not because of homosexuality, but because of the breakdown of marriage and family. Homosexuality, marriage is part of the breakdown of marriage itself. But you can fix homosexuality and say, well, we're not going to legalize that. great, we're all celebrating, but you still have a breakdown of family and marriage and government and nationality. Do you understand what I'm saying? How hypocritical is it to protest homosexual marriage? And indeed, it is corrupt. It is wrong. When it's not going to fix anything. It's just going to stop the decay. It's just going to stop the cancer in one particular area for a little while. We have major problems. Judah had major problems, but he is ready to burn Tamar. Let's burn Tamar. Yeah, it'll make us feel better. Judah, you're so messed up. Tamar being a prostitute isn't, well, yeah, that's what they should do. She should have been a, that's not saying that was right, but the whole storyline here, it's a lot deeper than just Tamar. If you read Romans chapter 1, homosexuality is one of the last things to occur in a culture that has already rejected God. It is one of the last things, one of the last signs that judgment is about to come. When you can get to a place where it's even thought about, you're in danger and on thin ice. And how close are you to when you're signing it into law? Say, this is a great idea. You are so close to judgment at that point. But it is not the reason for judgment. It is just one of the signs that judgment is close. Our problem goes back to the basic violation of the responsibilities or the institutions God established. Individual responsibility, marriage, family, nationalism, and government. When those things get back in line, gay marriage will not be an issue. But it's easier to shout about gay marriage and ignore the fact of all the areas we've already failed in. Gay marriage, the reason we're shouting about gay marriage is maybe it's already too late. Whoo! Okay, well, I'll pray and we'll be dismissed. Father, we thank you so much for the truth. We ask that we may walk in your ways. We ask that we may rise above the culture, rise above the times, that we may see the things that you've given to us, that we'd respond to your word, that we would do the righteous things. Father, we do ask for strength in this church and strength in all the churches to proclaim the truth, that we may again see revival in our own times. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.